A warning to our listeners. This episode contains strong language.
Previously on Looking for the Tote Family.
None of us can make sense of this. Like, it's just so mind-boggling.
It seems like a switch was flipped and something happened.
On the same day Tot was arrested in Florida for the murder of his family, the U.S. attorney here in Connecticut tells me that he was also arrested for healthcare fraud.
It was just living a double life, and you can't do that for any length of time.
It just shows you what you see on Facebook is obviously not what's in real life.
Something happened. Something made him become mentally unstable. That's my opinion.
A part of me still to say wonders, like, what went so wrong?
From the day in New London, Connecticut, I'm Taylor Hartz.
And I'm Sten Spinella.
And this is Looking for the Tote Family.
So, how should we go about this?
On a foggy February night, Sten and I wound our way through rainy back roads in Massachusetts to hopefully speak with someone for this podcast.
Do you want to talk? Or do you want me to talk?
I'm fine talking.
I don't normally get nervous before doing an interview, but this time was different. We were about to knock on the door of a convicted attempted murderer, and to be honest, I was kind of scared.
I literally have like a pit in my stomach. I'm so nervous.
In the first few days of this investigation, we heard about a part of Tony's past that was eerily similar to his current situation.
This is their street.
I dug through old newspaper archives from Philadelphia and learned that Tony's dad, Robert Tote, had been convicted and sentenced to prison for hiring someone to kill Tony's mom, Loretta.
Okay, is this where we're parking?
Let's move up a little bit.
Tony was just 4 years old at the time and was home when someone broke into his house and shot his mom in the face.
You got a business card on you?
I do.
We tracked down Tony's dad to see if we could talk to him about this tragic night in Tony's childhood and the tragedy that had just happened.
I have pepper spray with me.
We tried messaging him on Facebook and calling him, but didn't hear back. Okay. So we found his address and drove to Massachusetts. Robert's wife, Danielle, answered the door.
My name's Sten. This is Taylor. We're with the Day newspaper in New London, Connecticut. We're hoping to speak with Robert.
We can't share that audio with you because Massachusetts requires two-party consent for audio recording, and we didn't get that permission from her. But she told us that Robert wasn't home and might be back later. We hung around Springfield for a few hours and tried again. But he still wasn't home the next time we tried, and Danielle seemed less thrilled about us knocking on her door.
If possible, could I leave my card with you in case...
So we left her with our business cards and asked her to let Robert know that we were hoping to speak with him.
Thank you so much.
We never heard from Robert after that trip, and I couldn't let go of the fact that I wanted to talk to him. So I wrote him a letter. A few days after I mailed it, I got an email. It was from Robert, and it said, "I am an open book," and asked when we could meet.
Shoot. Ask your questions. You want to put them on there?
We set up a time in March to speak with Robert at the Hartford Public Library.
My name is Robert Anthony Tote. I am Anthony John Tote's father. I was charged with attempted murder, criminal solicitation, criminal conspiracy, 40 years ago.
Our interview lasted more than 2 hours, and no question was off limits.
I have it on record, forgive me, but I'm going to ask you.
Go ahead.
Did you shoot your wife?
Absolutely not. I had nothing to do with that. The first time I found out anything happened in my house was when I came home March 19th, 1980.
You didn't ask anybody to do it?
I would never ask somebody to do it.
For almost 40 years, he has denied any involvement in the attempted murder of his wife.
Did no.
Ever plan to have your wife killed?
No.
He figures if he tells you long and hard enough that he had nothing to do with this, you'd believe.
Alan Rubenstein was the assistant district attorney who prosecuted Robert Tote. He has a different take on what happened in 1980.
Look, you talk to Robert Tote for 20 minutes about anything, and you say to yourself, this guy's full of crap.
No, I would never, never hurt somebody. I never have started a fight in my life. I've ended some by laying on the ground and being beat up, and I ended some standing on top and doing it the other way. But I have never initiated anything, nor would I. It is not in the cards for me. I would not allow someone in my house with my children sleeping upstairs to do anything.
These two relitigated the case 40 years later in interviews 6 months apart. While Rubenstein has a conviction and a convincing narrative on his side, Robert seemed to have an answer for everything.
Despite what young prosecutors will tell you, most of them were ambitious. Now, I was 34 years old, raising two young children, and I loved the job. And I took up this case knowing it would be tough to prove.
Rubenstein is currently a judge in the same county where he was once a young, hotshot assistant district attorney. In 1980, he was primed to try and convict Robert in an attempt to seal up a high-profile case.
I received a call from a police lieutenant in our largest township, and he related to me that there was a terrible crime. It looks like a home invasion robbery.
On March 19th, 1980, someone went into the Tote's home in Bensalem, Pennsylvania in the middle of the night and shot Loretta Tote in the face.
The police investigation was very intense. And one of the things you do is you try to rule out people. Usually when a spouse is killed, and she didn't die, but his object was the killer, you always look for a husband, a boyfriend. You know, most homicides aren't committed at random. There's very few psychopathic killers out there shooting people for no reason. So we did a background on Robert Tote, and they kept me abreast of it every moment, every step. And, you know, there were a lot of red flags, there's multiple affairs.
Rubenstein alleged that not only did Robert have multiple affairs, but that he was engaged to another woman while he was still married to Loretta.
And there's an arrogance about that. Think about this. You are married to a woman. And you are engaged to a woman in a neighboring township, and the entire congregation is aware that your upcoming wedding will occur shortly. You know, they're congratulating these young men on choosing a nice bride from their congregation. Except, you know, a short ride away is apparently a happily married woman with two lovely children living the dream in the suburbs. So there's an arrogance about that. And the arrogance, I think, caused him to believe that no one would ever suspect him and he would never be caught. And that type of arrogance is fatal because it did him in the end.
While Robert denies being involved in the crime, he does admit to having an affair with a woman named Colleen. In fact, he says he was at Colleen's house the night of the shooting.
When I came back from Colleen's, so I'll put it as it was, I was with her until 11 o'clock that night, I think it was. When I got to my house, there was three cop cars out front. I got out of the car, what the hell's going on? And they said, Loretta's been hurt. I remember going up the hill, which I had a front yard that had a hill in the front. Got to the front doors and a cop stopped me. And he said, where are you going? I said, my house, you know, get the hell out of my way. I went into the kitchen, and Loretta was with my neighbor standing. He had a towel over her eye and a towel around her head.
Loretta, covered in blood, called police to her home and was rushed to a hospital where doctors discovered a bullet lodged near her eye. Loretta lost her eye and still lives with that bullet lodged in her skull to this day.
Well, at least at first blush, he was an attractive man with a great gift of gab. He was bright. He was engaging. And he seemed to be, as he at least appeared to be to many, a good guy, a pillar of the community. But too many things didn't fit. And he wouldn't admit to anything. He wouldn't say anything, even when we confronted him.
2.5 months after the shooting, police brought Robert in for questioning and accused him of hiring a young man named John Cermani to shoot his wife.
He says, you hired him. So I hired him to do what? To kill your wife. And why would I want
that to happen? So you could run off with another woman and get married. I said, you know, you guys are living in as the stomach turns, okay? It's ridiculous. Okay, that's, you know, I had an affair. I kept it quiet for 4 years. What the hell would I want to do now to basically send it wild?
The only thing that Robert and Rubenstein seemed to agree on was that Robert had questionable moral character at the time of the shooting. Rubenstein used this as a way to imply a motive for what happened to Robert's wife. Robert used his affair as an alibi.
Well, he never expressed the motive because he never admitted to this. It's the obvious motive. He was, as they say, living double in a world of trouble. He was engaged to a woman. He was married. And maybe the walls were closing in on him. And he figured, what do I do? Most people would file for divorce. He decided to hire John Chiaramonte to kill his wife.
Robert suggests a different motive for the crime. He says he believes it was a robbery gone wrong.
They thought I had drugs in the house. I'm 27 years old, with, at that point, about a $90,000 house in 1980. Today is worth about $300,000, $400,000. Had no mortgage or a very small one. They thought the only way it could possibly happen was drugs. John Tremonti, hey, look, I taught his brother. John Tremonti, I never knew in school. I had no idea who he was.
Back in 1980, Robert was a 27-year-old special education teacher and wrestling coach at Bensalem High School. John Tremonti, who was 20 at the time, was described in a Philadelphia Inquirer article as an admitted burglar and drug addict.
John Tremonti was the perfect assailant given Robert to. John, for lack of a better term, was slow, as we said. He wasn't the sharpest knife in the rack. He wasn't inherently a bad person, but he was easily swayed. We found that to be true when we spoke to all of his friends in the neighborhood. And he respected Robert Toad. He was almost in awe of him, to the point where if Robert Toad said something to him, he accepted it without any discussion.
Tremonti testified against Robert Tote as part of a plea agreement. Court records showed that Tote gave Tremonti a revolver, bullets, and the key to his house. During the trial, Tremonti told the court that Robert told him to shoot Loretta and to make it look like a burglary.
Come on, guy. You need to see this, John Tremonti, okay? It's not somebody you would trust with walking your dog, let alone anything else, okay? And I never knew the kid from school. He was never in school when I was there. Okay, I knew his brother, who was in my class, who had a lot of problems, and I met his mother twice.
Robert denied having any relationship with Tremonti other than being a teacher and a mentor.
I mean, I worked with John at my house also. I had John in my house, never alone. But with me, we did applications, we did how to write a resume, which was 5 lines, probably. I didn't finish high school. I was in special ed, that type of routine. I got him to fill out paperwork. That's it. And I did that for a lot of kids. You know, isn't that what we're supposed to do as teachers?
But Rubenstein painted a much different picture of their relationship.
He was someone who really liked Robert Toad. He had said to me, I think Mr. Toad is a really cool guy. And, you know, he has a nice home. He has a nice car. He's well-spoken. He's well-liked. He's athletic. And, even a normal, quote-unquote, guy might be impressed with Robert Toad because he shows well. So John really liked him. He just said he's a cool guy. He said that a bunch of times. But I don't think he was a bad guy to the core. He didn't have that hardness of heart or that coldness of disposition, which you might see in somebody who pulls a trigger on a woman asleep. I didn't think at all he had a mean bone in his body, but, he was sort of like under the spell of a combination Rasputin and Svengali, and he would do it.
Robert seemed to have an explanation for just about every piece of evidence presented in the case against him. He had a long list of reasons why he shouldn't have been convicted, including claims of evidence tampering, corruption within the police department, and problems with the ballistics report. We won't dive into those claims, though, because we aren't here to investigate Robert's case. He was tried and convicted by a jury, and that conviction was upheld by the Supreme Court of Pennsylvania. During the trial, Robert's wife Loretta, the victim of the shooting, stood by her husband. She testified on his behalf in court. In that testimony, she said, "I'm not sticking up for him because he's my husband. I'm sticking up for him because he didn't do it." She gave reporters a similar message in 1981. According to the Philadelphia Inquirer, Loretta had received a letter from someone who was following the case, who called her a dutiful spouse for standing by Robert. That letter made her angry, she told reporters. "I'm not sticking up for him because he's my husband. I'm sticking up for him because Bob didn't do it."
She was steadfast for many, many years that he couldn't have possibly done this. And one of the things that I remember vividly was when the verdict came in, there was wailing in the courtroom. Tote's family was wailing. Some spectators were wailing.
They came out and said it was guilty, and my wife stood up screaming. And I looked at the jury, and five of them were crying, and I was like, "How dare you? What are you crying about, you know? You know, this is your verdict. I'm going to jail for something I didn't do, and you're crying?" And my wife, the victim, is screaming bloody murder.
The calmest person in the courtroom was Robert Tote. Not that he expected it, because he didn't expect it, but it's just a coldness that's almost difficult to comprehend. But the evidence against him, in the end, albeit circumstantial, was compelling. And the jury, God bless them, saw right through him.
John Tremonti was sentenced to 2 to 4 years in prison for his involvement with the shooting. He's now serving a 10 to 20 year sentence stemming from a 2015 arson conviction in which he tried to defraud his insurance company by burning down his own house. Robert served 10 years of a 10 to 20 year sentence, but still maintains that he is innocent.
That is the last thing he is. He's cold. He's calculating. He's unfeeling. It almost seems as if he's trying to convince you that he's innocent, knowing that he's not. But it is typical as his behavior throughout the course of the trial. He was absolutely convinced in his own mind that all he had to do was take the witness stand, be placed under oath, and he could convince anybody that this was a frame by an ambitious prosecutor, and he had nothing to do with this, and he was the victim. And didn't work. He was a terrible witness. I think any doubts that the jury may have had about what happened here were put to rest when they saw him, and he was on the stand a long time. And he was almost, for lack of a better term, fun to cross-exam.
Rubenstein said Robert does acknowledge certain failings in his past. For example, he admits to having an affair. But, Rubenstein said, Robert was engaged to be married, and it wasn't just some meaningless affair. And while Robert says he's guilty of being a bad husband, he denies ordering the killing of his wife. Robert's remorse is part of his good guy act, according to Rubenstein. He accepts partial blame, but never takes full responsibility.
I hold, and I have carried for a long time, a lot of guilt. And I still carry it today. And it's not guilt about what happened. It's guilt that I wasn't where I belonged the night my wife and my children were hurt. I was out, pardon my French, getting laid. You have no idea what that emotion can feel like.
This is a cold-hearted guy. And I'm not going to throw around the term psychopath because I'm not a doctor, but he seems to fit the definition of an unfeeling, uncaring guy. No remorse. His remorse is that he was caught. Story.
The possibility that Robert and Tony were both psychopaths was floated by experts in news reports 4 days after Tony was arrested for allegedly killing his family. Unsurprisingly, Robert was not happy to read this.
I read reports, and I read everything, of psychologists, don't know Tony from a hole in a wall. I don't think they know themselves from a hole in a wall. And they're calling me a psychopath, and that that can be passed down to my child. Guys, I've got almost a master's degree in special ed. I know what psychopath is. I've been through that, and I look at everything that they're talking about, and they're full of shit. Part of my French.
Robert expressed anger about one news story in particular from the Hartford Courant, published January 17th, that tried to analyze a connection between Robert's crimes and Tony's. The reporter spoke to a psychologist, a psychiatrist, and a former FBI agent. Robert took issue with some of the quotes from those experts. For example, the father never admitted any responsibility, and the mother for years had supported him. Maybe out of a need to make it right, and from a psychotic perspective, the son commits a similar crime, sets himself up to be caught, then confesses. Or another one. You would want to look at patterns of behavior of the father and the son. And then one more put simply, psychopathy can have a genetic link.
The goofballs who decided to write those articles, and I don't know if it's your paper or their paper or whoever it was, I don't really even care. I got their numbers, their phone numbers, by basically going online, and they taught at the colleges, and I got their extensions, and I left them a message. I said, you know, it was very polite, okay? Hi, I'm Bob Tote. You wrote about my son, Anthony John Tote, okay? I'm the one you called schizophrenic or whatever the hell it was that you called me. Why don't you at least call me, and we'll talk about it, and we can find out what you know and what I know. You're one of them. So one of these days I'm going to drive down to the college and I'm going to meet him. And that's just the way I do things. You got something to beef with me straight up, I'll go toe-to-toe with anybody. I'm 67 years old, and I bench 318 pounds. Okay, so you want to go, we'll go, you know. Unfortunately, I still have the Philly attitude. But, you know, what are you going to do?
By reading court records and newspaper clippings from the 80s, we tried to piece together what happened in that house the night Loretta was shot, much like we've been trying to piece together what happened in the house in Celebration. According to a report from the Inquirer, Loretta said her memory from the night of the shooting wasn't very clear. At one point, she offered to undergo hypnosis to remember more details for the trial. In a 1981 report, she said she remembered tucking Tony and Chrissy into bed and then going to bed herself. Later in the night, she said she woke up to find one man in bed with her and another man standing in her bedroom. Tony also said he saw two men in the house. He was interviewed by police the day after the shooting and said that he wandered out of bed toward his mother's bedroom, where a man picked him up and carried him back to bed.
Somebody put their hands on my kid in my house and caused damage that's out of this freaking world.
I don't know if that happened. We never really could confirm that that occurred. Understand, even under the best of circumstances, it's very difficult to get a good interview from a four-year-old.
If it has something to do with what he saw as a young man in that house, I'm going to carry some of that guilt because I should have been there.
Even if they disagree about who was responsible for Loretta's shooting, both men agreed that it must have had some effect on Tony.
I almost feel sorry for him, if that's the right term, because he was a three-year-old toddler. And although we don't know what happened, he was awakened because he heard the shot. And he walks into his mother's bedroom, and he sees her bleeding profusely with her head on the pillow. And what he thought, I don't know. And there was also some indication that the shooter, John Ciarmani, may have picked him up and put him back in the bed. So maybe he didn't understand what was going on. But on some level, his mom is not there. She's in the hospital for an eternity. And as he gets older, he gets to understand what his dad did. And then, of course, he has to deal with the fact for 10 years he doesn't have a dad at home. So if he didn't know what happened that night, he certainly knew later on. And while that doesn't justify anything, he had to be traumatized. And it might explain why he did what he did, although it can never justify.
Robert recalled returning to the house the night Loretta was shot and seeing Tony.
He was sitting up in his bed with a blanket on him. And not like moving or anything. I had checked my daughter first and she was sound asleep and just picked her up, made sure all the parts were there. Why we do that, I'll never know. But I went into Tony and he was sitting there and he's just staring at the wall. Now, come on, it's 11:30 at night, you know, and there's 10, 15, 20 people in the house. You know, I stayed with him for maybe 2 or 3 minutes, laid him back down. My mother came over. I asked her to stay there. Don't wake him up, but just stay there in case he does get up, you know. And went to the hospital.
The next night, sitting in his father's lap, young Tony spoke to a detective.
We were downstairs in my mother's basement. I had him on my lap. I had him calm and talking. And, you know, he was, let's say, a little hesitant with Detective Hopkins, but Detective Hopkins pulled his handcuffs out, and Tony thought that was fantastic.
So there was some indication that he heard the shot and remembers in the most oblique way somebody putting him back in bed and said, go back to sleep. It might not have happened. It may have happened, but we do know that he went back to bed.
I think what bothered Tony is that somebody picked him up. Okay, we actually switched his bedroom, okay, in which Tony was in the front room and Christy was in the back room. We switched them, okay, so that maybe he would not have as much understanding of what's going on.
Robert said he saw a change in Tony immediately after the incident.
Tony started to have emotional problems that I was aware of, and that Loretta, my mother was one of the teachers at the school he went to, which was St. Ephraim's. At that point, after the shooting of my wife, he was restless. I mean, we slept together in my at my mother's house because the police took over my house. And you can tell when a child has experienced something, the quiet moods they get into and stuff like that. And that was never Tony. One of my biggest memories of Tony is him riding his big wheel and with the kids down the street and screaming and hollering. He wanted to be the, what was the name of that show? Duke Boys. Okay, and he would ride up and down the street and the kid in back would say he's the sheriff, and, you know, I could sit there and watch him for hours. After Loretta was shot, he became very much an introvert. He kept things inside. He didn't really want to drift too far. I know when I went away, Loretta tried to get him into baseball, but he was very, you know, inside himself. I think what my opinion, and I don't know this for factual, is that maybe moving up here brought him out of that, took him out of that environment, and, you know, he became a little different. But there was a change.
If Tony hadn't gone through that trauma as a child, do you think that Megan and your grandkids would still be alive?
Yes. My son and my daughter have gone through hell, absolute hell, by what they've had to read. My son, by the name he carries. But I'm sure as hell, one thing for sure, is that Tony wouldn't be where he's at today. Megan would be home picking up one of my grandchildren, and the kids would be playing a piano.
Shortly after defending her husband in court, Loretta filed for divorce. She and her children, Tony and Chrissy, continued to live in the house where she was shot. According to reports in the Inquirer, remnants from fired bullets still marked her headboard and nightstand. A reporter for the Inquirer wrote in 1981 that the Totes' home remained a sort of lived-in attempted murder scene, a reminder like a chalk outline around a since-buried homicide victim, that something awful happened. In December of 1981, the same year she defended her husband's innocence and filed for divorce, Loretta remarried. She married a man named Erwin Schmidt, a member of the Navy from Philadelphia. They moved to Montville, Connecticut, with Tony and Chrissy. The Philadelphia Daily News reported in 1984 that after moving to Montville, Loretta had a change of heart. The woman who once passionately defended her husband told reporters that she thought Robert Tote had tried to kill her that night and had wanted her dead so he could marry one of his former students. Loretta told reporters that the move from Bensalem to Montville gave her clarity about the case and her marriage, and that she believed Robert had tried to kill her multiple times before the night she was shot. She told reporters that being away from him and the whole situation in Bucks County, it all started to make sense. His lies, his cheating, it just got to the point where I couldn't take it anymore. I always knew there was something going on, but before, I thought it was just me. I tried calling Loretta last year and even went and knocked on her door, but she didn't want to speak to me about her case or about the case against her son.
Robert tried to reconnect with Tony and Chrissy after being estranged from them since 1982, and he eventually found them on Facebook.
It was either 2010, 2011. Between my sister, myself, my mother, and everybody else, we found out how many Anthony Totes are in the United States, because I believe we talked to every one of them. We talked to one gentleman down in Tennessee. We talked to three people in California, Anthony John Tote, one person in Milwaukee. I finally, you're not going to believe this, but it's true. On the 28th of December, 2010, I was on Facebook and started to do searches on Facebook. And I saw Anthony John Tote. I saw where he lived. He was a physical therapist, and he was from Philadelphia. We were, okay. Anthony Tote, my name's Robert Tote. Are you from Philadelphia? And he wrote back, and he said, yes. We wrote for about 3 or 4 days. And I said, look, I would give my right arm to talk to you on the phone. He said, it'll come. And probably 2 or 3 days later, he called me on the phone. My daughter called me on the phone right after that. In the beginning of March, I think it was, we made arrangements to meet. My current wife, myself, Anthony, and Megan, who you cannot help but love. If you've never met this young lady, she is a mother among mothers. She's incredible. And I got to meet my my daughter, which was tough, and my son-in-law. Great people. Okay, I have no issue. Loretta and Erwin did an unbelievable job in raising them. I mean, they came up, they talked, they didn't know what to call me. They call Erwin back. I said, call me Bob. It's okay. I gave up the title of daddy a long time ago, guys. I'll always be your father, but I'm not your dad. We went and met for a lunch down in Connecticut at some place. I can't remember where it was. And at the end of it, I said, okay, where do we go from there? How do we continue? And Chrissy said, well, would you like to go meet your grandchildren? And yeah, I mean, you know, I'd give my right arm. What do you want?
After almost 30 years of estrangement, Robert traveled to Tony's house, and he met his grandchildren for the first time.
And I can remember walking into the kitchen, and then three of them are running around the house like banshees. And I'm like, you know, something. Your feet become numb, your arms become numb. I just stood there. I had to be 15, 20 minutes.
It was clearly a very emotional experience for Robert, But the reconnection was fleeting.
We stayed there for about 3 or 4 hours. I told Danielle, you know, let's not overstay our limit. You know, this is a traumatic time for the kids, for the grandkids, and everybody else. And Ella came over and gave me a kiss goodbye, crying my eyes out. Went to the car, drove home. 2 days later, my sister Gloria died. She died of lupus.
Robert saw Tony and Chrissy again at his sister's funeral, where his children met his huge Italian family. But Robert noticed something off about his son and daughter.
For some reason, you could tell that they were, you know, almost like wanting to go into a shell. I couldn't explain it. We went to lunch with the family and everything like that as normal, and walked them outside and said goodbye and kissed my daughter and kissed my son, as I would always do. I don't give a shit what people say. And they got in the car and drove away. And about an hour later, I called, and there was no answer. So I texted. I said, are you guys okay? And they text back, yes. Following day, I got a email from Tony and said, you have to leave me alone for a while. I can't tell you why, but right now I just can't do it.
Robert had little to no contact with his children over the next 10 years.
And I think a lot of things started to come back to Tony. At least that's what Chrissy had told me. You know, he's having nightmares. He hates you again. I'm like, why does he hate me? Because you left him. I said, I didn't leave him. I was picked up and carried out of the house, you know, going to jail, for lack of a better term. I didn't get carried out of the house. I just walked out. But that was it.
Because they'd fallen back out of touch, Robert was unaware that Tony and the family were missing until January 12th, the day before Tony's arrest.
I got a text from Chrissy that said, have you been in contact with Tony? Which just, you know, it took me by absolute surprise. And I'm like, no, what are you talking about? You know, you guys told me to stay away. Is everything okay? Not a response. Well, following day, everything went to shit. I didn't know anything until 2 days after that. My sister called me on the phone. She said, are you okay? Like, what is it with you people? I get one from Chrissy, I get one from you. Are you all goofy? She said, you don't know. I said, well, obviously I don't know, since I'm, you know, here and you're calling me. So that's when she told me the three of them were gone. I was walking our dog, my dog. And I can remember Nina, you know, beginning to tell me that, you know, Chrissy, Tony, and Megan, and the three children. Never met the little girl. I never met Zoe. I knew that he had her because I've seen pictures. But she had said that Tony killed the three of them. I'm like, what are you talking about? All three of your grandchildren and Megan are dead. I'm like, if you're messing with me, okay, I'm going to come down to Philadelphia and I'm going to hurt you. And she said, Bob, go to the internet, type in Anthony John Tote. I ran back to the house with the dog, hung up with my sister, and that's when I found out.
In late January, the family was able to hold funeral services for Megan and the kids after finally getting their ashes back home to Connecticut.
So I texted Chrissy. I said, look, I really do want to go to the service. Would you mind? And she said, I said, I'll let you make the decision. I don't want to cause anybody any pain, especially Loretta or yourself.
And she wrote back and said, I don't want you to be there. And I told her, that's a tough one to swallow, you know, but out of respect, I'll swallow it.
Robert respected Chrissy's wishes not to go to the funeral services, but he went to the church afterward to pay his respects.
I had gone down, but I waited till everything was done. You know, there, nobody was there, no crowds, no nothing. I did get to see the urns. There was no ability to walk, no ability to move. Probably the most horrible feeling in my life. And I've been through a lot of things, and nothing is horrible as that.
When we talked to Robert in March, he was a man who had just lost three grandchildren he'd barely known. He was still coming to terms with the fact that he might be losing his son yet again. At that point, Tony had been in jail for about a month and a half. Robert had sent him letters, but had not yet heard anything back. We followed up with a phone call to Robert in November.
Hello.
Hi, how are you?
Oh, I'm good. How are you?
And he told us that things had changed.
Oh, yeah. I talked to him at least three times a week, if not more.
In the son who was absent most of his life, Robert now sees his own experiences reflected, namely, sitting in a jail cell for a crime he said he didn't commit.
It's a very lonely world that he's in right now. And I'm speaking from experience, okay? He's just looking for, you know, some reassurance that, you know, life's going to be okay and, you know, someone to talk to about just nonsense. You know, I mean, we talk about a lot of things, you know. And it's tough for a young man like Anthony who didn't grow up in a tough world. You know, I mean, he grew up in a Connecticut upper, let's say upper echelon type area, you know, so it's even more difficult.
One change we noticed in Robert between the two interviews was in his assessment of Tony's guilt or innocence. Back in March, the only information Robert had about his son was what he could read in news reports, including the confession mentioned by the Osceola County Sheriff. Now, after having regular conversations with Tony, he isn't sure about his guilt. He's hopeful that someday his son may be free.
The only thing him and I have really talked about is, you know, once he gets out. And let's just say that's the way we're believing everything goes, okay? I want him to sit down with somebody, talk to somebody, not somebody sponsored by the government or the jail system or anything else. I said, you know, I want you to get with somebody who can sit there and listen to what you have to say. Because, you know, you went through a lot.
Depending on how you look at this and who you believe, you have a father and son who either both committed unimaginable crimes against their own families, or who are both deeply sympathetic figures who've lost almost everything they had in their lives and now only have each other.
Put yourself in my shoes and just try to justify you've just lost three grandchildren and a daughter-in-law. You hang on every word, you know, I mean, to try to say, hey, there is something there that we have in common.
The similarities in Robert's and Tony's stories are eerie. When Rubenstein talked about some of the things that made Robert's case so memorable.
You have all of these factors, which are not usually attendant in most cases.
A lot of what he said was almost word for word what people told us about Tony.
You have the suburbs, you know, peaceful, calm.
It's just a quaint little town.
You have someone who, at least superficially, is well-respected in the community.
They did a hero of the day over the holidays, and Tony was one of them.
For example, I am sure people said, oh, he couldn't have possibly done this. She's such a lovely lady. They're deeply in love. They have two young kids.
He loved Megan. He loved the kids. He loved his life.
He was a well-respected teacher and wrestling coach.
He was a physical therapist, and he touched so many of us and so many of the kids in town.
Very affable, engaging.
He was very friendly.
Always laughing, always smiling.
He was well-liked by members of the community, and he had the perfect family.
They appeared to have the perfect family.
And what did they always say when these things happen? And they happen on occasion throughout the country. They always interview a neighbor who said, "Boy, I never would have thought this would happen."
Nobody saw this coming.
He was a great guy. I really liked him.
Tony was one of those people I really thought I knew.
They must be just mistaken. It couldn't be Mr. Tote.
That's not the Tony Tote I knew.
He was, as they say, living double in a world of trouble.
It was just living a double life, and you can't do that for any length of time.
Robert and Tony's reconnection after Tony went to prison didn't surprise us. At this point, the father is watching what happened to him happen to his son. He is seeing the constant news coverage, seeing a man without his family. He is waiting to see his son face a judgment that will determine his life. Much of what we've heard about Robert, we've heard about Tony. They were well known and well respected in their suburban communities, with public-facing jobs that often deal with children. They each had lovely families. Everyone was surprised by Robert's accused transgressions, just as no one can make sense of what happened to Tony Tote's family. Just as Robert may have been on the brink of another life when he found a new wife, Tony and his family had found Celebration, a Disney-designed Florida town of immaculate upkeep and a reputation for flawlessness. In the next episode, we go to Celebration, where many families move for a fresh start, a blank slate, or alternatively, an escape. But it seems the Totes couldn't outrun their problems.
You'd be shocked at how many people have a heart's desire to come to Celebration in the town that Disney built.
It's kind of like the American dream, and it's also going back to, I think, what all of us wish we still had.
Some people come here thinking, oh, it's perfect.
People come to Disney World hoping to get out from under their problems.
If you move here thinking it's going to fix them, it isn't. If you don't fix your problems before you go somewhere, you just bring them with you.
If you or someone you know is in crisis, help is available. Call Mental Health America's crisis hotline at 1-800-273-TALK. If you haven't already, please subscribe to Looking for the Tote Family on your favorite podcast app. And don't forget to rate the show. Find us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. Looking for the Tote Family is hosted and reported by Taylor Hartz and Sten Spinella. Produced by Peter Huapi and Carlos Virgen. Written by Taylor Hartz, Sten Spinella, and Peter Huapi. Editing by Peter Huapi and music by Carlos Virgen. Tim Cotter is our executive editor. And Izaskun Larnieta is our managing editor. Social media management by interns Josette Moses and Allison O'Donnell. This has been a production of The Day in New London, Connecticut.